Are there any questions or anything to share?
Today you spoke of kindness and tenderness and the critical snake, and I was wondering if you had anything else to say about the kindness and tenderness to help combat the snake.
So about kindness and tenderness and the metaphor of the snake that I used yesterday to mean a lot of different things, but including where that criticism that can take over, like an anger directed towards ourselves as a kind of snake bite. That we are a snake that we keep putting in our pocket. And if I could say more about the kindness and tenderness. So much more. Yeah. Partly because it seems to be our main actual work. So if we understand our path is really clearing what's blocking the experience of what is, we're not trying to create what is. We're not trying to create something that's real or true. We're just finding ways of clearing away so that our access to experience fully what is grows, so our access grows. And the non-kindness is mostly what's in the way. So partly we've been brought up on that. And partly we haven't made experiments to find out what happens. What happens when kindness? And it's partly because fear kind of gets us by the neck. So kindness, again, is not something that we want to make up and try to do. But we're afraid to allow kindness because the experience of kindness is an opening to allow something natural to happen. And it feels more like vulnerability. Real kindness. So there could be the way that something that looks like kindness isn't soft, isn't open. We can use kindness to try to get approval or to get our way or something as a way to buy attention or approval or power. And that's a sickness, an addiction and a sickness that we need to really take seriously because it's very hard to get out of that one. When we're kind and we get approval for kindness, that fake kindness. It's one of the hardest addictions to get out of. But it can help us feel, if we feel the difference between fake kindness, whether it's coming at you or whether it's coming out of you. So trying to be nice so that you'll be accepted, trying to be nice so that you can go first or whatever. Feel superior. We can just so clearly feel the difference between that fake kindness or any other kind of addiction and the actual moments of kindness. And so, as usual, I'm suggesting we can go by our own experience, even if we're sure that we have a poverty of experiences of kindness. It doesn't matter. Because the experience of kindness is being in touch with something real. And so that one little tiny flash of kindness, a half moment of kindness, still, we can still smell it. And in fact, we're still, it's enough fuel to go for quite a while. We can still nourishes. So one way is to actually go back to moments of kindness, to remember them and to let it come into the body-mind, bloodstream, muscle, memory. And to feel what that specific moment feels like, and then what that other specific moment feels like. So felt like, feels like. And sometimes it's more like a smile that can spread through the whole body, room, world. And really to take the time. So the suggestion is actually let there be a whole hour where you let that smile spread to your toes and to your ribs and your hair and to the room. Just keep letting it spread. Or that might be more of a taste of what just happened. We could recognize the kindness in what just happened, but we weren't being kind. Like, there was no intention to be kind. It happened. So that's another flavor we could, again, suggest to the body-mind, get into that and let it spread. And we can clearly feel here the difference between the way criticism spreads, the way it takes over, and the way it's really a gentle practice of, but not giving up, of finding that tiny thread of kindness from that moment way back when, enough to remember, enough to go by. Is it enough? Wait, yes, okay, feeling it. When we feel it, yes, it's enough. When we think it, it's not enough. When we feel it, it's enough. When we think it, it's not enough. When we feel it, it's enough. And then we lose track again, and then again, letting it have us. So we can feel the difference of something like a trap that can take over the criticism, the small-mindedness. And how different, and what are the qualities of difference in that smile or that, I wasn't there and something happened and I can just smell the goodness of it. Like fresh air in the nose. We could easily doubt that we're smelling something if we stop and think about it. So don't. Or when we do stop and think about it, it has no way to understand what we're doing. Shht. So there's room to be like, shht. Later, thinking, later, stop. Now feeling. So what you might discover might be really in its own way, but I'll just give a few samples. One is a kind of sense of that where kindness came from, or a kind of sea of kindness that can act in specific situations. There's a sense of it already being everywhere, but at the same time, a process of letting it come through the whole body and mind. So in other words, it could feel very familiar and very strange at the same time. Very old and very new. Like coming home and like untying the boat and just being out in the stream. There's a what we could call basic goodness feeling that we don't so much have to practice liking. So we do need to practice unliking, pretend kindness. We do need to practice unliking whatever we're addicted to. But we don't really need to practice liking basic goodness. It's again just allowing permission that not only liking, loving, and so hungry for that basic goodness. It feels good in the body and in the mind and in the world. There's usually a lot of feeling like, really, am I allowed? Are you sure? Really, there's permission? And as part of the process of learning back our kindness, so like recovering the human repertoire that's somewhere in us. Just as simple and innate as the physical movements that developed as we grew up. We just didn't have a culture that supported that development of the repertoire of kindness in action. I think I'll actually kind of pause here to include some examples of that repertoire because it can help us distinguish better from the fake kindness. So the genuine kindness can be fierce also. There's a lot of talk these days about empathy, and there's research about how important empathy is. But kindness is maybe deeper than empathy. So kindness could empathize, and I get how you're feeling, and I actually don't care because I can feel a deeper place in you that wants freedom, that doesn't want to be held down in that cage of all that emotional reaction. And kindness can see and feel through all the emotion. To what's more important, to what at the end of our life we would know that's important. And so when we're caught in fake kindness, it's not that we're consciously trying to get a good deal or trick anybody. We're just caught in an unhealthy pattern that we were taught, miseducation. And so each of us can start to feel, with that softening of like, yes, whatever you feel, we all know it. So yes, we can agree. Everything you feel is already allowed, it's okay, and we all know how that feels. So there's no need for shame about any feeling. But in what way is that emotional level? So it's never only emotional, emotional body thinking level, the reactive. Trying to get protection. So understandably. So criticism is one big way, strangely, that we're trying to get protection, even though it so hurts us. And it can sometimes help to kind of sit side by side with the critic at the same table and understand we have the same project. We both want safety and protection. And let's just look over the like annals of history. How has it gone over here with the criticism thing? Ow, 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 ow. And I have nothing over here. I don't know, because we haven't tried anything. So what if we try something else? I have no proof. But at least every single page, whenever we tried criticism or small mind, it never worked, and it always hurt somebody, and it also always hurt me. And so protection, not hurting, right? And so it can really help to feel with the critic, ally. Yes, we want protection. And then we can start to question, protect what again? Because mostly we're protecting the protection. But really feel there's not an easy answer. What? Protect what? What's inside all that protection? What's the initial wish in touch with what? The protective urge. So it's partly like reducing the flames, the fire of against the critic. That no matter how badly it went, was there an initial contact with something that felt so soft and open, precious and vulnerable, that there was an urge that then went wrong? So then if the critic isn't wrong, it's much easier to meet the critic, the criticism. Maybe even not calling it the critic. So feel how it works for you. Sometimes it's really helpful to give the name of T-Rex or whatever name, or Uncle So-and-so. And sometimes it's helpful to just notice it's this process that keeps happening. It's not, there's no body there inside me looking down on me, actually. Then I can feel, oh, my posture is a posture of being looked down on. And then I'm free to actually influence my posture as a not looked down upon posture. Not about looking down upon or being looked down upon. And so part of kindness there is to say, clearly and honestly, I have no proof and I have no guarantee, but I want to go over here. where there's no guarantee, rather than stay here. So come. Usually we think of kindness as something kind of like a small mammal close to the ground and keeping things warm and nestled, which is sometimes the way, but there's also a knowing that the carpet has been pulled out and under the carpet there's no floor. There's no proof that another way exists or will help in any way when we know we want protection. But I see that trying to get protection is hurting. So one whiff of kindness is that gambling mind. I'd rather lose everything than keep doing the same. And partly with that, we can call it gambling or maybe we can call it windfall, where there's like ready for a windfall because we have no tools. Partly with that windfall mindset. No button that I can push can bring genuine kindness. No button that I can push can shut up the critic. But I also first recognize I have never really given a chance to another way. So sometimes people, for example, with money, they'll wonder like, oh, it feels impossible. But they've never actually tried another way. They feel so tight and worried and caught up and unstoppable. But actually, they haven't tried. They haven't actually tried another way. And then we notice, I'm just afraid to try another way. That's all. So what? So again, the fear aspect. In a way, we can notice when criticism is happening, what came before it, some kind of alarm, some kind of sense of unsafety. So let's call it fear today. Then we can notice, even first, that's already huge to notice, behind criticism is fear. And then we can notice, have we met fear ever, really? Or have we always run away? Have we always been moved by fear rather than into feeling it? And Jay Krishnamurti dares us to actually feel it. And then to ask ourselves, with what are we feeling the fear? To live with a living thing such as fear requires a mind and heart that are extraordinarily subtle, that have no conclusion, so that's the windfall mind, and can therefore follow every movement of fear. So this is already huge. Then if we observe and live with it, and this doesn't take a whole day, it can take a minute or a second to know the whole nature of fear. If we live with it so completely, we inevitably ask, if you're Krishnamurti anyway, who is the entity who is living with fear? Who is it who is observing fear, watching all the movements of the various forms of fear as well as being aware of the central fact of fear. So not only getting caught up in this kind of fear, that kind of fear, this story, that story, but also this very basic fear of our vulnerability. Is the observer a dead entity, a static being, who has accumulated a lot of knowledge and information about ourselves? And is it that dead thing who's observing and living with the movement of fear? Is the observer the past, or is it a living thing? What is your answer? Do not answer me, answer yourself. And then he answers after a while. So first, feeling in a way two ways that we could meet fear. And what we're really saying is we as kindness meeting fear. Or as where kindness comes from or lives, meeting fear. Because non-kindness is, I am fearful. I'm acting because of fear. And that is non-kindness. So not letting fear move me, but moving to it, into it, meeting it. There could be two ways that we meet it. There are two ways that we meet it. One that we've put a lot of emphasis here is that already awareness, already receptive, just feeling as it is. And we can instantly feel that aliveness in it. But so easily, observing fear, trying to meet fear, it's not just allowing it to be as it is and feeling it, receiving it. The observer is the sensor, C-E-N-S-O-R, the one who's sensoring, not the one who's sensing. The one who's basically saying, I'm feeling you, but no, we're going to block out these passages of the book. The observer is the totality of all our experiences about fear. The observer is separate from the thing we call fear, forever trying to overcome it or escape from it. And so it's basically a battle between ourself and fear. This battle, which is such a waste of energy. And so Krishnamurti suggests that if we really could be honest and kind of give up the battle, we'll notice that mostly what we think of as the observer is merely a bundle of ideas and memories without any validity or substance. First of all. And so a lot of our practice is noticing that when I'm observing actually as a sensor, as someone who's there to cross out what we don't like, what's not allowed. Being in battle with what is. And then secondly, so the observer often is a dead thing. It's what I already experienced, my ideas about fear, fighting the experience of fear. And then, meanwhile, the fear itself that we think is wrong, partly because it has pushed us around so much, we've let it drive the boat. But that fear is an actuality. The fear is alive. So we would have hoped it was the other way around. We would have hoped that the fear was just some old leftover momentum from the past, and that our nice, safe little observer there was that really living thing. But so often, it's the other way around. But if we can feel how easy it makes our work now, that hard work of battling experience to try to make it be right is death working on life, is the dead in action. And the actual experience, no matter what it is, even fear, is alive. So, and he calls it an actuality, a fact. We're trying to understand a fact with an abstraction. We're trying to understand a fact the fear, the living experience, with ideas about fear. But in fact, is the observer who says, I am afraid, any different from the thing observed, which is fear? The observer is fear, and when that is realized, there's no longer any dissipation of energy in the effort to get rid of fear. So we're by allowing fear to pose as meditation, to allow avoidance of life to pretend to be really observing things, taking notes, getting it right, and just to realize that all that effort is fear in motion, posing. It's a huge relief, actually. It's just incredibly humbling, especially if we've been doing that as meditation for a long time, or as whatever, inner work. But to feel how much energy is relieved of a job when we know that that observer is just more of the same. Then the time-space interval between the observer and the observed disappears. So the illusion of some separation between me and my experience is gone. When you see that you are a part of fear, not separate from it, that you are fear, then you cannot do anything about it. Then fear comes totally to an end. That's that windfall. That's where what we thought was a snake with venom turns out to be a snake with nectar, that waking up snake. And still there are a few simple, almost simplistic things that we can do to bring up kindness. Since we're kind of a bit crippled in the area of kindness, it can really help. It's like going to physical therapy after an accident or something. Like. And one is laughter. If you've been around kids, and right now my two kids have been for months now, it's wonderful. I know it will end, but it's such a good phase for months now where they have so much fun together. And every half an hour, you know, my son is at my daughter's throat again, but still. Their project is laugh. Whatever will make us laugh, let's do it. So that we can hardly keep walking across the house to do the little whatever it is that's going to be so funny. That's sort of the retreat energy. The project is laughter. What, you know, if your whole energy like a child could go into that. And similarly, not quite the same, similarly, is joy. So, for example, we come into the hall. Which way of letting the body be on the ground feels more joyful? It could be that you thought you loved lying down and you find yourself sitting up. You just feel like a flower. Or it might be that you just feel terrible, but you just feel this barely like a little bit more light. Let's go with that. At the end of the day, it could be wonderful to just invite and allow, like the tide coming in and then going back out, and what did it leave? Today, some moments of joy, what were they? Or some moments of transparency or stillness or friendliness. Any kind of moment where we felt the feeling of that the walls came down. And the walls coming down, that's that getting out of the way so that what is happens. The walls coming down can be scary, can be fresh, can be a lot of movement, can be just utter stillness. Could be stillness and movement, movement and stillness. But we could take note that when the walls come down, what is it like? Because it's so light and ungraspable and home. It fits us so well, we can hardly feel it. There's a poem by Kabir where he says, "Put on your gown of love silk and dance." And just recently it struck me as love silk, we would feel naked. But something so nice on the skin, too. Not only the air, something else. That would remind us of a silkiness, a silky nature. No matter what torment, still a silky nature. So sometimes I even give numbers to it, like at the end of the day, allow 3 or 5 moments of joy to come to mind. But then it could be, then enact or embody, bloodstream it. Feel the shape, feel the texture, where, what. Put on the gown of love silk and sleep. And it can be sometimes all about lightness and very strenuous, just to get through the interference, getting through the walls, the protection, just staying true to that tiny little shred of a feeling of the pleasure of stillness or simplicity or no demand. Just staying true, staying true, staying true. In India, there's the word satyagraha. And graha has many meanings, but it can be the feeling of a home. And satya is usually translated as truth. Here, today, we can say, like, what is. So being at home in what is, that no matter what the interference, what kind of hallucinations, what sense of a wall feels between me and any experience of anything subtle or silky or loving, the tiniest little hint of maybe that's not all. Tiniest little hint of silkiness in the body mind. And staying true to come through the walls, to disbelieve the walls, the protection, the reactivity. Another suggestion is during the day, not waiting till the end only, but during the day, 5, for example, or 100, or 1. Suggestions of love, loving yourself. Suggestions to yourself that you're loved, that you love you, that life loves you, that the world loves you. And sometimes it may come to mind and then immediately get sort of batted down, like, no way am I doing that here. Someone might see me. I might see me. And that could wake up an interest in just doing it then. That's where the kindness can be quite mischievous. But the satyagraha is also another word for nonviolent action. And it's a very helpful tip that staying true to what is, there's no need for the battle with even the resistance, the avoidance, the critic. There's no need to actually, I mean, we can sometimes like engage the critic, so to speak, and sit down together and agree we have the same project. We both love safety. We both love safety, why? Because we really care about precious love and living. Okay, let's go. But otherwise, just actual non-engagement with all that torment. And there's also feeling for a word or image that reminds you that you're allowed, it's allowed to be at ease. It's allowed, you're allowed, you have permission to be here. And to love what you love. And we start to discover, again, that love of what we love. In moments, like appreciation of something that you happen to find beautiful, which is partly your conditioning, and also partly an experience of beauty. What is that experience of beauty? Where? What's happening? So there's a trigger, but then what's the happening? It's again like spreading open a little bit to experience what is. And we could all day and every day, with that image or word or words, keep tuning in. May I be happy. And the critic will say, that sounds so stupid. What a stupid word. May I be happy. May I be happy. Then may we be happy. I consider Henri Matisse to be one of my elders, though of course I didn't meet him. Sometimes in the presence of his paintings, I've just found myself on the ground. And I find it helpful to hear how it was for him to be Henri Matisse. His paintings were a work, a lifetime work of kindness and tenderness. Of bringing about a non-dual space with whoever would come in to contact with the painting and be a viewer. He would bring us into the space that's two-dimensional, three-dimensional, and some other dimensional. And he kind of knew what he was doing, and he kind of had no idea what he was doing. At the beginning of a painting, there was not this image in his mind that he just had to copy down. He had to just really work with the canvas and the space that he was creating until it was that simple that it was sacred, that it was kindness, that it was tenderness. And so as we let go of the unnecessary battling, we just recognize that so much of what would try to notice what's happening is just another thing to be noticed. It's more fear in action. And then we find ourselves that we land in life and that it's okay. And that it's new. Then there is some struggle, a very alive struggle, because we have a sense of we can feel what feels true, what feels satya. But we don't know what it's going to look or act like or say ahead of time. And so we try that and that didn't work. And of course, the criticism can come. That was really bad. What you said, oof. And so if we know that it's like that, incredibly messy, Henri Matisse would, they hardly had money. But the whole family was together on this project of tenderness on canvas. And so they didn't have enough money for paint, but even so, he would do a painting that he could have sold for plenty. It was a still life that so many people would have bought, but it wasn't true. It wasn't staying true to what was emerging in him. And through him, in the collective. And they would just all scrape the paint off. They would help him scrape the paint off so he could do a painting that was real. But maybe no one would want to buy until he was crippled and couldn't paint anymore. But he was one of the rare ones who did get some recognition while he was still alive.
He did those amazing cutouts.
Well, that's why, and he couldn't paint, then he worked with paper. Yeah. Does that come across, that two different kinds of struggle? And one of them just burns us out. One of them takes everything, and we need ventilation. Like, he would just have to stop, and Amelia, his wife, would, let's go on a horse ride. Come on, let's get out of here. Get out of the studio. In order to bear the process. But it was a living process that gave more and more and more. It took everything and gave everything. Took everything and gave everything. And we also, so it's not only someone who's recognized as a genius. I really feel all of us have that edge inside where we can feel, and we could have the confidence to let something emerge and to know and practice recognition of, is this staying true? It helps so much if only we would have the whole family there in some way, at least one other person who can help us scrape the paint off. The paint that we can't afford to replace, but somehow we will. Because it's life's project. That's the cool thing. When we start to feel that we love, and we let ourselves love what we love, we clearly recognize it's not me. And sometimes I'm actually kicking and screaming along there in loving what I love. No, no. I don't want to be that open to that incredibly beautiful flower. There was a teacher who's called The Mother, also from France, actually. Partly from, but lived mostly in India and founded Auroville, a community there in South India. And she said that if we would have any clue what powerful forces are moving through a human being, we would basically, not in her words, be completely freaked out. But it's sort of, all we need to know is loving what we love. And staying as true as we can to that, and having enough help to give birth to what we don't know what it's going to look like, but we can feel a resonant feeling, resonant knowing. Yes. That is a life worth living, and that. Denise Levertov, who is a poetess who is born in England and lived in the States, says that when she was little, she used to run at top speed across a room in her house and bang herself into each side of the room. When I was 5 and undifferentiated energy, animal spirits, pent-up desire for the unknown built in me, A head of steam, I had no other way to let off. I ran at top speed, back and forth, end to end of the drawing room, bay to French window, shouting, roaring really, slamming deliberately into the rosewood desk at one end, the shaken window frames at the other, till the fit wore out or some grown-up stopped me. But when I was six, I found better means. On its merry gallows of dark green wood, my swing, new built, awaited my pleasure. I rushed out to it, pulled the seat all the way back to get a good start, and vigorously pumped it up to the highest arc. My legs were oars, I was rowing a boat in air. And then from the furthest forward swing of the ropes, I let go and flew. At large in the unsustaining air, flew clear over the lawn across the breadth of the garden and fell Icarian, I'm not sure how to say that, like Icarus, dazed, among hollyhocks, snapdragons, love in a mist, and stood up uninjured, ready to swing and fly over and over. The need passed as I grew, the mind took over, devising paths for that force in me, and the body curled up, sedentary, glad to be quiet and read and read, save once in a while when it demanded to leap about or to whirl, or later still to walk swiftly in wind and rain long and far into the dusk, wanting some absolute, some exhaustion. So it's not that all forces in the psyche would be considered as friendly, but there's a kind of tremendous power in us that can be put to the spiritual path. It can be put to something better than protection, something more protective than protection. So kindness and tenderness, even when it feels very far, we can get the hang of it. And it can be so finely tender that it can get right through any wall. Any floor. Any ceiling, roof. And that's part of the trick, is just confidence in it. Knowing that it's in it, it's in the aliveness. We don't have to make it up. It's in the structure of us, physically and everywise, that openness that's at the center of everything. That when we're not much in contact with it, feels intimidating, scary, blank, unfriendly, but in it, is so much friendliness, even to include death. Certainly no problem to include fear and that observer. Maybe I'll just end with a really simple poem by Wendell Berry. To feel how even despite all these forces, the discipline of letting go of that one kind of unfruitful struggle and giving ourselves to that struggle of fruitfulness being born, that's not only for the individual, but for the collective. It's also just so simple. It is late November, Thanksgiving, and the slow rain falls as all day it has fallen. The mists drift in the treetops along Camp Branch, which is the name of the stream near his home. The ewe flock grazes the green slope as in a dream of a painting by Samuel Palmer. There is no wind. It is completely quiet. From the distance comes only the sound of the branch flowing in its wooded hollow, old, old and new, unidentifying the day and the man giving his thanks. So in that the unidentifying is no injury. Takes nothing away. May all be at peace. May all be well. May all live in freedom and die in freedom. And know the living that includes living and dying. May our practice and our lives be dedicated to the movement towards liberation for all, including ourselves.